This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamotu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today I have with me
Mike Morris.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Okay, now Mike, you've been looking into the Tangiwai disaster. What can you tell me about that?
You know, my first memory of that was I was a child living in Napier at the time, and I was outside the house. This was on Christmas morning, and my mother came out and said that there'd been a train disaster and people killed near Kuni. That's the only memory I have from my early days of it. I don't remember much of the news after that.
So how old were you then?
I was 13.
13, okay. Yes, so old enough for it to strike a significance of
yes,
it. Yeah.
Yes, but 1953 was an interesting year in New Zealand. There were quite a few events in the New Zealand history. For example, on the 6th of January, Godfrey Bowen set a world record by shearing 456 sheep in 9 hours. Well, that's unimaginable. I believe that record has been broken several times since then, but that was a world record for 1953. Then the 29th of May, Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay conquered Mount Everest, which is believed to be the first time that anybody has reached the summit of Mount Everest. And after that, Edmund Hillary was knighted and became Sir Edmund Hillary. And then there was the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II on the 2nd of June, and she, of course, is a Queen of New Zealand as well. Then she came to New Zealand for a royal visit on the 23rd of December, arrived in Auckland on the royal yacht, the Gothic, and only a day after that, 24th of December, we had the Tangawai rail disaster. So it was quite a year. The Tangawai rail disaster happened with a train. In those days, that was the most popular way of travelling, was by rail. So there were two trains that left Wellington for Auckland each day, and there were two trains that left Auckland for Wellington each day. There was the express train that left about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It stopped at quite a few stations on the way. And then a couple of hours later, it was what was called the limited train, because it stopped at a limited number of stations, and it made a faster trip. And it was
so the express was slower than the limited?
Correct, because of the number of stops it had to make.
Okay.
On the 24th of December, express from Wellington to Auckland left Wellington at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was a full train because the 24th of December, it was holiday time. Lots of people were wanting to travel and go to their families for Christmas, etc. So it was a full train. And it had 5 second-class carriages and 4 first-class carriages and a guards van and a postal van. And there were a total of 285 passengers and crew. The second-class carriages and trains in those days with first-class and second-class carriages, the second-class carriages were the ones that were right behind the locomotive, so they got the full blast of any smoke and so on going through tunnels. And then after the rear of the train were first class carriages and the guards van. So okay. The train on the 24th of December leaving Wellington for Auckland, full train, and everything was going well. It was running on time up to Wairu. It left Wairu on time, and then as it headed towards Aokuni, between Aokuni and Wairu, is a place called Tangawai, which is known these days for its forestry and felling trees and exporting trees from the forest there. Tangawai in those days, this notable thing was that it had a bridge, rail bridge, going across the Whangaheu River. So the Whangaheu River, which, as I said, crosses the road between Aukuni and Wairu, and then it heads south through settlements, one of them Mangamahu, and then it comes out of the coast between, it's between Martin and Whanganui, this side of Whanganui. As the train was approaching Tangawai, also on the road alongside, because the road and the railway line run parallel to each other at that point, on the road in a car was a man called Soren Ellis, that's right, and he was travelling from Taihape towards Aukuni, and as he approached Tangawai, he could hear a loud roaring noise, and he thought it was torrential rain, but it wasn't raining. What had happened was that the Mount Ruapehu has a crater lake which empties into the Whangaheu River, and its outlet had been blocked by rocks and snow and ice and other debris, and so the level of the crater lake had risen. And at that particular time, on the night of the 24th of December, the blockage of that lake cleared all of a sudden, and the contents of the crater lake emptied itself into the Whangaheu River and collected up debris and boulders and silt and all sorts of things, and it became a laiha, which is a torrent of water racing down the Whangaheu River. And that's what Cyril Ellis could hear the roar of. And he was approaching a road bridge which was alongside the rail bridge, and he could see water flooding that. And he thought, this is not good. He knew that there was a train approaching, so he stopped and got a torch and ran to the railway line to try and flag down the train. And he waved his torch, and nobody knows really what the driver and fireman saw, whether they saw this torch and what they did, because neither of them survived the crash. But the train carried on to the river bridge, and by that stage part of the bridge had collapsed, but the train drivers didn't know this, and the locomotive careered off the collapsed bridge and ended up on the opposite bank of the river. There is a suggestion that the train driver and fireman did take some action. They must have seen the torch and they must have taken some action, because when they pulled the locomotive out of the debris sometime later, the controls of the locomotive were in such a position that indicated that it was breaking. And that perhaps sand was being applied to the rails as well to help with the braking. So the locomotive ended up in the river on the opposite bank, killed the driver and fireman, and then first five carriages, they're second class carriages, they followed into the river, and some of them were washed downstream a wee way, and others were left on sandbanks, etc. And the rest of the train, the sixth carriage was a first class carriage, and that was teetering on the edge of the bridge, the collapsed bridge, at a steep angle. By this time, Cyril Ellis had witnessed what was happening, and he ran to the rear of the train where the guard was, told him what had happened, and he and the guard went to the carriage that was teetering on the edge, climbed in and told everybody in that carriage to go to the rear of a carriage to try and equalise the balance. And one of the other passengers in that carriage. Also.
Were the carriages connected so they could get through to the next one, or they had to?
They were connected, yes.
Yeah, okay.
As a complete train, they're all connected, so you could walk right through the whole train.
Yeah, okay.
So they shifted as many passengers as they could to the rear of that carriage. So
were many injured in there?
No. Okay. We'll come to that.
Oh, okay.
But then, soon after that, the coupling with the rest of the train, the first class carriages which remained on the railway line, the coupling broke, and that carriage fell into the river. Then, fortunately, it didn't fall into the main flow of water. It ended up on a bank or somewhere like that. So Cyril Ellis and the guard and this other passenger were in the carriage, and they managed to get all the passengers out through broken windows. They broke windows and got all the passengers out. So everybody in that carriage lived except one girl who apparently died. Why she died, I don't know. So they were very fortunate, that carriage that fell into the river, they were able to get all the passengers out. But the previous carriages that had gone in, the second class ones, everybody perished on that one. And then there was the remainder of the train, the first class carriages and the guards van and postal van. They remained on the rail, on the railway line, nobody was hurt in that. So the train was, as I said, a large part of the train was washed down the river, just a wee way. Most of the carriages might have only gone a few hundred metres and then got lodged in debris or banks or something like that.
Would they have been full of water, or...?
They would have been. The Leja subsided very quickly, apparently, after the derailment.
Yeah. Okay.
The crater lake had delivered as much water as it could at that stage, and the level of the water in the river went down quite fast.
Yeah,
okay. So there are other people that are aware of the disaster. There are people living nearby. There was a timber camp nearby. So they activated the Wairu military camp, which is not far away. And the military camp sent as many personnel as it could there to help.
Yeah.
And they transported a lot of people back to the camp and fed them and gave them a bed to sleep in, etc. And then eventually a lot of bodies were retrieved and taken back to the camp as well. 151 people died. 148 of those were in second class carriages, and there was only one person in the first class carriage that died. And then there were 20 bodies that were never found.
So, and no survivors at all from the second class then?
I believe not.
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
Then some of the bodies were washed down the river, and it's believed that most of the, if not all of the 20 missing people that they never found, were probably washed out to sea.
Yeah, you don't expect that.
But down the river, there were bodies and debris for kilometres. And Mangamahu, which is a settlement partway down the Waiahu River, the people around there were fishing bodies and debris out of out of that river for a long time, and laying the bodies out in a wool shed, and then eventually they'd be put on a truck and taken to Whanganui. Not only bodies, but there was a huge amount of debris.
So was there much damage done to settlements further down the river, or?
I don't think so. I haven't read anything about that. Mangamahu is elevated above the above the river, so it wouldn't have affected them much. I mean, they're very close to the river, but still elevated high. above the river.
Okay. I suppose the disaster would have been after that. Maybe they did far more serious monitoring of crater lake levels and things like that.
Yes. The mountain is well alarmed now, and there's alarms to detect volcanic activity.
Yeah.
You can look in on a website and see what the current level of activity is on Mount Ruapehu. And then there's monitors on the Waigahu River, and they send alarms to the railways people as well as police.
That wouldn't give much notice, though. How long would it take for the water to have come from the Crater Lake down to where the bridge was?
Well, apparently it's the best part of a couple of hours. The rail disaster was 10:21, so I believe about 8 o'clock, apparently.
Eight at night, yeah. And the, yep, no problem.
Because the Waigahu River, when it leaves the Crater Lake, doesn't go directly south. It goes in a south-easterly direction towards the desert road, and then it runs parallel with the desert road down towards Wairu, and then it turns towards the west and then heads out to Tangawai.
So that would have been pretty dramatic then for anyone driving along the desert road, suddenly seeing that.
I have a feeling that the desert road was flooded. I haven't been able to find any evidence of that in researching this, but my memory tells me that the road was flooded for some time. And certainly, once they installed alarms after the disaster, there are alarms on the road between Okuni and Wairu. So if there was an excessive flow in the Waigahu River, the alarms would go and there are automatic gates that closed across the road. I don't think they're there these days. And likewise, there was a similar thing, alarms and gates across the... that would close across the desert road north of Wairu. I know that alarms, not only from the Waigahu River, but other places around Mount Ruapehu, alarms were sent and monitored at the Tongariro powerhouse at Tukanu. And it was their job, if an alarm exceeded a certain threshold, they were to ring or notify Royal Age Police, Civil Defence, and all the other authorities, depending on the nature of the alarm.
Okay.
But maybe these days it's more automatic, and maybe the alarms go direct to police and railways.
Yeah, you'd expect so now with the technology we have.
That's right. So I think the Waigahu River and the Crater Lake, they're well monitored these days, and it's unlikely that such an event will happen again. The Waigahu River bridge, the rail bridge, was out of action, obviously, it was out of action for quite a long time before they could replace it.
Yeah.
What do you do with the trains that would use that? Because there's a lot of trains travelling between Auckland and Wellington. And there's a railway line, it's not used by railways these days, but there's a railway line running from Okokura, which is north of Taumarunui, and it goes down to Stratford, and that joins up with the New Plymouth to Palmerston North or Marsden railway line. Well, trains would have been diverted that way, but that's a fairly tortuous route. It's quite hilly, and there's lots of tunnels, and it's certainly not a high-speed route. But nevertheless, they would have used that while the Waigahu Bridge was out of action, and they would have diverted trains down that line, but that would have added several hours to a trip between Auckland and Wellington.
Yeah.
So as I said, Wairu military camp, it was fortunate having them close by this rail disaster. They stepped in with all their personnel and helped out there, provided meals.
Yeah.
Just south of Wairu, the Navy had a communication station, HMNZS Irirangi. HMNZS, because it was classified as a shore-based ship. And they had a communications channel, and they also helped out with communications and also providing meals for the people that were involved in rescuing, salvaging.
Because there wouldn't have been I don't know. What was the civil defence structure then? We have something fairly formal now.
There basically wasn't anything.
Yeah. Okay.
It was sort of ad hoc. You just grab who you could.
And pull it together.
And do the job,
Yeah, and communication would have been difficult, I suppose. Telephone lines, telegraph or something.
Yes. I have an article that a radio technician with broadcasting in Wellington was phoned early one morning and told to grab all the gear that he could and head to Waiuru.
Mm.
And so he did that, got up to Waiuru, and they were able to provide him with a telephone line, direct telephone line to Wellington. So they were able to connect into the radio studios in Wellington, and they were able to broadcast information then from Waiuru over the radio through that telephone line.
Okay. Would you have disrupted the Queen's visit as well? Was she going to go by train up to, between Wellington and Auckland?
Now, that's an interesting thing. Typically, when the Queen travelled in New Zealand, there was a royal train. And she often used that. Whether she was scheduled to go by train from Auckland to Wellington, I don't know. All I know is that she flew down there, but she did use the royal train later in her New Zealand tour.
Okay.
But she is recording a Christmas message, Queen's Christmas message to the Commonwealth. She does acknowledge the train rail disaster that happened in New Zealand.
So I know it's marked now because there's if you go, I found when they were doing roadworks on the desert road, so instead of travelling north straight up the desert road, they were diverting people through Awakuni past a memorial for Tangiwai. And it was interesting, there's a cafe at Awakuni where I went in, and I think they got so tired of people asking, they put up a sign. Yes, it is great, the road is closed, business is great, we have lots of customers, no need to ask. But I found it took no longer, and it's actually a very pleasant route. You've got more possible stops on the way than going over the desert road and so on. So it's... directed a few drivers to take that alternative route. It's maybe a bit more scenic.
I've travelled that route many times because I used to live in Taumarunui. So travelling, say, Wellington to Taumarunui, that's the way you would go.
Well, I find it, going to Auckland, that there's the idea, is it for truck drivers, they're supposed to stop every 2 hours. And you, if you go that route, you can have your stop. So, you know, it takes just about 6 hours or so driving time to get to Auckland. And you can actually get stops after 2 hours and after 4 hours. If you go the desert road, you got to stop a bit earlier at Waiuru because there's nothing much for a while after. So, it just makes the breaks more even.
The people that died, their bodies, as I said before, some of them were washed 120 kilometres down the river past Mangamahu. Bodies that were recovered and could be identified, they were either released to their families and they had their own funeral arrangements, but quite a number... There was no family connections and no funeral arrangements. So there is a grave at the Karori Cemetery in Wellington, and there are 16 people buried there, and 8 of them are identified people and 8 are unidentified people.
Okay. Which says something about either the time it took to find the bodies or the nature of the accident if the bodies were not able to be identified.
Yes, well, of course, the bodies were, some of them were in terrible condition, full of silt and other damage, and some of them might not have been identifiable.
I suppose now with dental records and things, it's a bit different perhaps. But
that's right.
But
as you said, there is a memorial at Tangawai now marking that spot. And on the memorial are the passengers that died in that accident.
Yeah, so they got the names of all of them.
Yeah.
So, because if you're travelling on it, would it have been a bit like an aeroplane? They need a passenger list with all the names? You can't just buy a ticket and go and they've no idea who was on the train?
I don't know. When you reserve, in those days, when you reserved a ticket on a train, you did give a name.
Yeah.
But whether the... How long that was held, I don't know, because I think if you're a casual traveller at an intermediate station and you bought a ticket just before the train arrived, you'd just be given the ticket. I don't think they would collect your name.
Yeah, I do know.
But
they were able to know exactly how many people. Well, they know how many tickets were sold. Yeah.
And the express train, that one that fell into the Whangaheu River, there would have been a following train a couple of hours later. The limited train, which left Wellington a couple of hours later. Mm. What happened to that? I don't know. I mean, obviously, it didn't get up there. It would have been stopped somewhere south of Wairu.
Two hours later.
Likewise, there would have been two passenger trains southbound. Where they were at that time, I don't know, but they would have been stopped.
There would have been goods trains as well.
There would have been goods trains as well. So there
was, I suppose the railway would have all the signalling systems, so that
Well, signalling wasn't automatic in those days. It was a good old semaphore signal, largely.
Yeah.
And they had quite a few train controls. I know that there was, at Tangawai, there was a railway station, and that was staffed.
And were some of these those where you had to, was it you picked up a disc or something and then you leave it at the other, so you can't go without the disc? So
your tablets, they call them.
The tablets, yeah.
Yes, and that required staffed railway stations to sort those out as well.
So there almost be an automatic, in the built-in system, it would have stopped other trains from going on the line.
True.
Or some of them.
Yes, that's true.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.